This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of nerve conduction studies from the hand section on orthobullets.com. Nerve conduction studies comprise of nerve conduction velocity studies and electromyography. Nerve conduction studies are used to localize areas of compression and neuropathy. They are also used to distinguish lower versus upper motor neuron lesions, as well as spinal root, trunk, division, cord, or peripheral nerve lesions. Nerve conduction studies determine both severity and prognosis. For example, a neuropraxia has a good prognosis, while axonotmesis / neurotmesis has a poor prognosis. Nerve conduction studies also demonstrate denervation, reinnervation, aberrant reinnervation, as well as motor end plate lesions. Nerve conduction studies can be valuable in workers' compensation patients with secondary gain issues. Indications for nerve conduction studies include carpal tunnel syndrome, cubital tunnel syndrome, cervical radiculopathy, lumbar radiculopathy, and nerve dysfunction of the shoulder, for example, scapular winging. Now, let's talk about nerve conduction velocity studies in a bit more detail. Nerve conduction velocity studies are tests that are performed on peripheral nerves to determine their response to electrical stimuli. As far as the technique, a constant voltage electric stimulator evokes a response from a muscle. This is a motor nerve study, or along the nerve, which is a sensory nerve study. The standard stimulus is a 0.1 to 0.2 millisecond square wave. For motor nerve studies, an additional stimulus is measured along the proximal segment between two points on the nerve. This is to overcome the inherent delay across the neuromuscular junction if the recording electrode were placed on the muscle. As far as measures in a nerve conduction velocity study, nerve conduction velocity equals distance divided by latency. Distance traveled is from the cathode of the stimulating electrode to the recording electrode. Again, distance traveled is from the cathode of the stimulating electrode to the recording electrode. Latency is the time from the onset of stimulus to the onset of response. Onset latency equals time from the site of stimulation plus time to activate the postsynaptic terminal, that is neuromuscular transmission time, plus time for action potential to propagate along the muscle membrane to recording potential. Nerve conduction velocity is determined by myelin thickness, internode distance, temperature, and age. Keep in mind that nerve conduction velocity in newborns are 50% of adult values, nerve conduction values in one-year-olds are 75% of adult values, and nerve conduction velocities in five-year-olds are 100% of adult values. An amplitude in a nerve conduction velocity is from baseline to the negative peak and is measured in millivolts. Keep in mind that the area under the peak is proportional to the number of muscle fibers depolarized, and the amplitude provides an estimate of the number of functioning axons and muscles. Again, the amplitude provides an estimate of the number of functioning axons and muscles. As far as duration, this reflects the range of conduction velocities and synchrony of contraction of muscle fibers. If there are axons with different conduction velocities, for example, in the setting of an acute demyelination, duration will be greater. Late responses evaluate proximal nerve lesions near the spinal cord, for example, Guillain-Barré syndrome. In these cases, you will see an F wave amplitude or an H reflex, which stimulates one alpha fibers at the knee with recording at the soleus or the S1 root. The H reflex is affected by sensory neuropathies, motor neuropathies of the tibial or sciatic nerves, and S1 root lesions. Demyelination leads to increased latencies or slowing of the nerve conduction velocity. Distal sensory latency of greater than 3.2 milliseconds are abnormal for carpal tunnel syndrome. Motor latencies of greater than 4.3 milliseconds are abnormal for carpal tunnel syndrome. Decreased conduction velocities are less specific than latencies. A velocity of less than 52 meters per second is abnormal. Now let's go over some findings on nerve conduction velocities. We'll go over the findings for latency, conduction velocity, amplitude, and evoked response in various conditions. So in a normal setting, the latency will be normal. Conduction velocity in the upper limb will be greater than 45 meters per second, and in the lower limb will be greater than 40 meters per second. The amplitude will also be normal, and the evoked response will be normal. In axonal conditions, the latency will be normal, the conduction velocity will be normal, the amplitude will be decreased, and the evoked response will be prolonged. In demyelinating conditions, the latency will be increased, the conduction velocity will be decreased, the amplitude will be normal or decreased, and the evoked response will be absent or prolonged. So again, demyelinating conditions will have increased latency, decreased conduction velocity, normal or decreased amplitude, and absent or prolonged evoked response. In the setting of an anterior horn cell disease, the latency will be normal, the conduction velocity will be normal, the amplitude will be decreased, and as far as an evoked response, this will be normal or polyphasic or prolonged duration. In myopathy conditions, latency will be normal, conduction velocity will be normal, amplitude will be decreased, and evoked response will be normal. In neuromuscular junction conditions, latency will be normal, conduction velocity will be normal, amplitude will be decreased, and the evoked response will be normal. In the setting of a neuropraxia proximal to the lesion, the latency will be absent, the conduction velocity will be absent, the amplitude will be absent, and the evoked response will be absent. If the neuropraxia is distal to the lesion, the latency will be normal, the conduction velocity will be normal, the amplitude will be normal, and the evoked response will be normal. So again, a neuropraxia distal to the lesion, the latency, conduction velocity, amplitude, and evoked response will all be normal. In the setting of axonotmesis proximal to the lesion, the latency will be absent, the conduction velocity will be absent, the amplitude will be absent, and the evoked response will be absent. In the setting of axonotmesis distal to the lesion, the latency will be absent, the conduction velocity will be absent, the amplitude will be absent, and the evoked response will be normal. In the setting of neurotmesis proximal to the lesion, latency, conduction velocity, amplitude, and evoked response will be absent. Finally, in the setting of neurotmesis distal to the lesion, latency, conduction velocity, amplitude, and evoked response will also all be absent. Moving on to electromyography, this is used to study electrical activity of individual muscle fibers and motor units. This is used to differentiate between diseases of nerve roots, peripheral nerves, or skeletal muscles. Electromyography is used to determine if a disease is acute or chronic and if there is reinnervation. It can also be used to determine if there is nerve continuity. As far as the technique for electromyography, you will insert a needle electrode through the skin into muscle to determine insertional and spontaneous activity. Types of activity include insertional activity, contraction activity, and spontaneous activity. Insertional activity will show the state of muscle and innervating nerve as the needle is inserted. Normal muscle has baseline electrical activity. Abnormal insertional activity, which corresponds to greater than 300 to 500 milliseconds, shows early denervation. Examples include polymyositis, myotonic disorders, and myopathies. Reduced insertional activity occurs after prolonged denervation, where the muscle undergoes fibrosis. In the setting of contraction activity, the patient is asked to contract the muscle and shape/size/frequency of the motor unit potentials are recorded. Finally, as far as spontaneous activity, normal spontaneous activity includes end plate potentials and end plate spikes. Abnormal spontaneous activity indicates some nerve/muscle damage. Examples include sharp waves, fibrillations, fasciculations, complex repetitive discharges, and myokinetic discharges. Fibrillations are spontaneous action potentials from single muscle fibers caused by oscillations in resting membrane potential of denervated fibers. This is seen in 3 to 5 weeks after a nerve lesion begins and stays until it resolves or the muscle becomes fibrotic. Fibrillations are also seen in muscle disorders, for example, muscular dystrophy. Fasciculations are spontaneous discharges of groups of muscle fibers and is found in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, progressive spindle muscle atrophy, and anterior horn degenerative diseases, for example, polio and syringomyelia. Fasciculations are also seen as a, quote, undulating bag of worms on physical exam. Now let's talk about various findings on electromyography. We'll go over findings of insertional activity, spontaneous activity, minimal activity, and interference in various conditions. So in the setting of a normal condition, insertional activity will be normal, spontaneous activity will be silent, minimal activity will show biphasic slash triphasic potentials, and interference will be complete. In the setting of axonal neuropathy, insertional activity will be increased, spontaneous activity will show fibrillations slash positive sharp waves, minimal activity will correspond to biphasic slash triphasic potentials, and interference will be incomplete. In the setting of demyelinating neuropathy, insertional activity will be normal, spontaneous activity will be silent, minimal activity will correspond to biphasic slash triphasic potentials, and interference will be incomplete. In the setting of anterior horn cell disease, insertional activity will be increased, spontaneous activity will correspond to fibrillation slash fasciculations or positive sharp waves, minimal activity will correspond to large polyphasic potentials, and interference will be incomplete. In the setting of inflammatory myopathy, insertional activity will be increased, spontaneous activity will correspond to fibrillations or myotonia, minimal activity will correspond to small polyphasic potentials, and interference will be early. In non-inflammatory conditions, insertional activity will be normal, spontaneous activity will be normal, minimal activity will correspond to small polyphasic potentials, and interference will be early. In the setting of a neuromuscular junction disorder, insertional activity will be normal, spontaneous activity will be normal, minimal activity will correspond to biphasic slash triphasic potentials with a decreased amplitude slash duration, and interference will be early slash normal. In the setting of a neuropraxia, insertional activity will be normal, spontaneous activity will be silent, you will have no findings with minimal activity, and no findings with interference. In the setting of axonotmesis, insertional activity will be increased, spontaneous activity will correspond to fibrillation slash positive sharp waves, and as far as minimal activity and interference, there will be none. Finally, in the setting of neurotmesis, insertional activity will be increased, spontaneous activity will correspond to fibrillations slash positive sharp waves, and with respect to minimal activity and interference, there will be none. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over one quick question to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. Demyelination of a nerve fiber will result in which of the following on a nerve conduction velocity study? And the choices are 1, increased amplitude, 2, increased latency, 3, normal evoked response, 4, no change in the conduction velocity, and 5, no change in latency. The correct answer to this question is 2, increased latency. So demyelination of a nerve fiber results in increased latency on a nerve conduction velocity test. To quickly review, a nerve conduction velocity test is a measurement of the speed of conduction of an electrical impulse through a large myelinated nerve. In this test, evoked responses are measured after stimulation of a peripheral nerve. Typical measurements include the nerve conduction velocity, amplitude, and duration. When a nerve becomes demyelinated or damaged, there is increased latency and overall decrease in the conduction velocity. By analyzing the results, one can differentiate between a normal nerve, demyelination, axonotmesis, neurotmesis, and neuropraxia. Common indications include carpal and cubital tunnel, radiculopathy, and nerve dysfunction of the shoulder. A thicker myelin sheath will affect nerve transmission by increasing the speed of wave propagation. Wilborn reports that the electrodiagnostic exam, including nerve conduction studies, detect demyelination injuries along large myelinated motor axons, as well as the sensory axons for position, vibration, and some light touch. Demyelination of the axon results in a block to conduction, focal slowing of signal transmission, and manifests as increased latencies on nerve conduction study stimulation proximal to the lesion. Clinically, focal demyelination manifests as decreased deep tendon reflexes, loss of vibrational sense, and intermittent pain and paresthesias. It does not, however, affect motor strength or sensibility. To quickly go over the incorrect answers of this question, answer 1, increased amplitude, is incorrect, as demyelination results in a decreased amplitude. Answer 3, normal evoked response, is incorrect, as demyelination results in an absent or prolonged evoked response. Answer 4, no change in the conduction velocity, is incorrect, as demyelination results in a decrease in conduction velocity. And finally, answer 5, no change in latency is incorrect, as demyelination results in increased latency. That's all for this review about nerve conduction studies. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.